AMOCO, Amoco. Amoco presents the Edward R. Murrow Program with Don Hollenbeck. When you wash your hands, the dirt that's on them doesn't just disappear into thin air. It just leaves your hands and goes into the water. The cleaner your hands get, the dirtier the water gets. Something like that happens when you use Amoco's Premium Plus Permalube Motor Oil in your car. Dirt leaves moving parts and is kept in suspension in the oil. Of course, the oil is dirty, but the engine is clean. That's what you want, and that's what Permalube Motor Oil gives you. Now here is Don Hollenbeck with the news.
Good evening. The Senate Crime Investigating Committee in Washington today resumed its study of the connection between its specific subject and New York politics. And in so doing, it knuckled under to a witness who declined to have his testimony made public by radio and television. The witness was Irving Sherman, described by the committee as a known gambler and intimate of racketeers, and he agreed to testify before the committee only if the microphones and cameras were switched off. His attorney said the witness did not choose to participate in the spectacle, that if he were being seen and heard on television and radio, his mind would not be able to operate with the calmness, clarity, and serenity so necessary to him. The witness himself said he just didn't want to be embarrassed, and he explained that one of the principal reasons he has been so reluctant to tell his story to the O'Connor Committee has been the fact that his mother is ill. The committee accepted all this with a straight face, permitted Sherman to tell his story with calmness and clarity and even serenity because Sherman was fully at ease on the stand, although this fact was shielded from the radio and television audience, which might have been tuned in. Sherman told how when William O'Dwyer, now ambassador to Mexico, was campaigning for mayor of New York in 1945, he had helped out in that campaign, and how a go-between had told him that O'Dwyer wanted him to get out of town at once in order to avoid newspaper publicity about racketeering in politics. Sherman learned later, he said, this publicity was an accusation by O'Dwyer's opponent that O'Dwyer had the support of Frank Costello, Sherman, and racketeers in his campaign. Sherman told the committee he did get out of town at once, but that when he came back to New York after O'Dwyer's election, he found the mayor's door was closed to him. In Mexico City today, Ambassador O'Dwyer gave only an indirect answer to Sherman's story. He noted that the go-between referred to is now dead. He added that next year is an election year, but he did not otherwise go into details. He didn't comment on Sherman's story to the committee of collecting $4,000, $5,000, or $6,000 for the O'Dwyer campaign fund. The O'Connor Committee has called Sherman the key link in its inquiry into the O'Dwyer election and has emphasized his importance as a business connection of Frank Costello, whose silence before the then Kefauver Committee last spring has resulted in his conviction on a charge of contempt of the Senate. At the conclusion of those hearings, the committee issued a report which noted that O'Dwyer's move seemed often to result favorably for men suspected of being high up in rackets. Ambassador O'Dwyer today told reporters he didn't care to comment more fully on these new developments. As he put it, let's hear it all first. And that's an observation the O'Connor Committee might have kept in mind today when it deferred to Sherman's desire for calmness, clarity, and serenity and stopped the radio and television reporting of his testimony. The fact that the television audience didn't get to see Irving Sherman twitch at his necktie or the radio audience didn't get to hear his story in his own voice may not seem to be too important, but the matter goes beyond this specific case. And that can be expressed no better than by CBS radio correspondent Bill Shadell, who, as president of the Radio Correspondents Association in Washington, today addressed a letter to Chairman O'Connor. I have asked Bill to read the text of that letter now, and here it is.
The Executive Committee of the Radio Correspondents Association held an emergency meeting at noon today to protest the action of the Senate Crime Investigating Committee in placing arbitrary limitations upon the news coverage of its public hearing this morning. We believe the Senate committee's action was taken without full appreciation of its implications. We believe the banning of radio, television, and newsreels from the hearing at the request of the attorneys for one witness is a form of discrimination against certain news media and a threat to all media under our democratic traditions of freedom of the press. To accept the thesis of the attorneys for the witness that the coverage of one media could make a witness a part of a spectacle is to say in our judgment that any news coverage of a public hearing makes a witness a part of a spectacle. It is our position that in public hearings, all news media have equal access to the reporting of the proceeding. We respectfully request that this action taken by your committee, after previously consenting to radio, television, and newsreel coverage, be reconsidered.
That statement just read by Bill Shadell carries even more weight when we remember that just the other day the Senate itself voted to proceed with contempt charges against two Cleveland witnesses who had developed television shyness, and in so doing, the Senate seemed to be giving a vote of confidence to the O'Connor Committee and to its plans to give a complete airing to its proceedings consistent with the public interest. It cannot be considered consistent with the public interest that the committee would reverse itself so completely as it did today, simply to avoid shocking the sensibility of a witness who has evaded its inquiry for weeks. In the words of Ambassador O'Dwyer again, let's hear it all. The allies in Korea have presented the communists with a take-it-or-leave-it proposition for ending the truce talks deadlock, and the leave-it alternative is a promise that the Eighth Army will undertake to drive the communists clear out of Korea if the talks break down. And that's a commitment which General Van Fleet says his forces are ready, willing, and anxious to assume. The take-it part of the proposition is that a sort of subcommittee be appointed by both sides to try to end the ceasefire zone deadlock in a more informal atmosphere than that which prevails around the council table. And word from Allied headquarters is that the communist team has showed more interest in this proposal than they have in anything previously presented to them for consideration. They may have an answer to it at the next meeting, which is tonight, United States time, Thursday in Korea. An interesting and possibly important sidelight on the Korean War comes to us tonight via a Voice of America broadcast. It says the Beiping chief of the Soviet news agency recently prepared a secret report on the Chinese communist leader Mao Zedong and his cabinet and recommended an all-out purge. That report is said to have accused the Chinese communist leadership of directly, actively, and deliberately sabotaging Russian interests in the Korean War, said the unwillingness of the Chinese generals to utilize resources and methods of combat was one reason why so many decisive Korean operations had failed. The report goes on to say that discontent within China is steadily increasing, that the so-called volunteers in Korea are tired of the war and want to go home, and that even within the Chinese Communist Party itself, opposition to Moscow is growing. And one more significant note in this report is broadcast by the Voice of America. It says the Chinese people are complaining that all Moscow seems to want is a weakened Chinese army so as to prevent any future trouble. In other words, no Chinese Titos. The House of Representatives had been scheduled to begin debate on the $8.5 billion foreign aid bill today, but other business delayed it until tomorrow, and the administration has given up hope of restoring the more than $600 million cut out of the measure by the Foreign Affairs Committee. Republicans would like to cut out one more $400 million item, and the extreme view is expressed by Representative Bursell of Illinois. He suggests a reduction of $3 billion on the ground that little or no economic assistance to Western Europe is now required. One development today may figure in the forthcoming debate. The head of Britain's Board of Trade, Sir Hartley Shawcross, today made it plain that doing business with Eastern Europe is strictly a matter of pounds, shillings, and pence so far as Britain is concerned. He says that short of general war, the English will continue to do business with communist nations, no matter what the United States of America may think about it. Legislation pending in Congress would bar all forms of American assistance to nations which do any trading in vital materials with communist countries. Sir Hartley says Britain's economic problems make it essential to continue trade with Russia and the satellites, and he made it known the Russians have reserved the right to cancel a $28 million timber contract with Britain unless Britain furnishes rubber supplies in return. Under American pressure, Britain last spring cut off all British rubber exports to communist China, but Russia itself gets about 6,000 tons a month, which, Sir Hartley says, is a quantity considered necessary for ordinary civilian requirements. Coincidental with the Shawcross statement, the Moscow radio today broadcast an appeal for an increase of trade between Russia and the USA. It expressed a view that a revival of Soviet-American trade would be a very valuable contribution toward a healthier world economy. It suggested specifically this country's machine tool industry could find a big market in Russia. Senator McCarthy of Wisconsin said today he's asking the four major radio networks for time to answer President Truman's speech yesterday at the dedication of the American Legion headquarters in Washington. That was a speech in which the president said that scandalmongers with rotten motives are stirring up public hysteria with irresponsible charges of communist infiltration of the government. The president did not mention any names, but McCarthy says the subsequent news stories and radio reports were unanimous in describing the speech as an attack on McCarthy and McCarthyism, and he says he wants time to answer it. In the Senate's investigation of communism, Whitaker Chambers is to be a witness tomorrow before the Internal Security Subcommittee. He's to answer questions about the Institute of Pacific Relations. It was Chambers' testimony which led to the conviction of Alger Hiss for perjury. The United States and Britain today made public the final draft of the peace treaty with Japan, and it's expected it will be signed at San Francisco next month, despite the noise the Russian delegation will raise in protest. This final version of the treaty includes no changes which would be expected to mollify the Russians. It does, however, make clear that Japan will be expected to pay partial reparations to the Allied nations it sacked during World War II. That clause is included in deference to the Philippines, which had threatened to boycott the San Francisco conference because the Philippines felt they were entitled to big damages from Japan. The treaty, however, makes it plain Japan's present financial position rules out complete reparations to any nation. Later this evening, over CBS, John Foster Dulles will discuss the Japanese treaty, of which he was an important factor. At Providence, Rhode Island today, John D. Rockefeller, Jr. was married to Mrs. Martha Baird Allen, 56, a former concert pianist, the widow of a former classmate of Rockefeller's at Brown University in the 90s. Rockefeller was attended by his son, John D. III. Two other sons, Nelson and David, were present. His other children are Abby, Lawrence, and Winthrop. Their mother, the former Abby Green Aldrich, to whom Rockefeller was married for 47 years, died 3 years ago. This is the third marriage for the new Mrs. Rockefeller, who'd made appearances with Nellie Melba in the Boston Symphony before she retired from the concert stage 20 years ago. On the obituary list today, at Axenstein, Switzerland, Arthur Schnabel, one of the world's foremost pianists, dead at 69 after a long illness. Schnabel was best known for his interpretation of Beethoven. He had been living in New York until recently when he went to Switzerland in an effort to regain his health. The 2,500-ton yacht, which a grateful German people presented to Adolf Hitler in 1935, is going to be turned into scrap metal to help fill the need for steel for this country's defense program. The yacht, the Grilli, is at Bordentown, New Jersey. It was brought here for exhibition purposes some years ago, purchased from the British Admiralty, and the dismantling will begin day after tomorrow. Scrap from Hitler's yacht for the defense of this country. This is Don Hollenbeck. I'll be back in a moment with a footnote to the news. Now here is Bob Dixon.
1 minute after midnight tonight, the state of Delaware is making a wonderful contribution to the comfort and convenience of the motoring public. At 12:01 a.m., the world's newest bridge, the $44 million Delaware Memorial Bridge, will be open for traffic. If you've ever driven from Maine to Florida or from New York to Washington, you can understand what good news this is, for the new bridge will eliminate a serious traffic bottleneck and make travel on this important highway more convenient. The makers of Amoco products salute the great state of Delaware for its foresight in building this bridge, the sixth longest suspension bridge in the world. If you're planning to drive along routes 13 and 40 in Delaware and then on to route 130 in New Jersey, you'll find the new Delaware Memorial Bridge will help shorten your trip and make it more convenient. By the way, if you drive anywhere from Maine to Florida, you'll find that famous Amoco products will make your trip more pleasant. If you drive over the new Delaware Memorial Bridge or along any highway from Maine to Florida, make it Amoco all the way. Now here's Don Hollenbeck with the footnote to the day's news.
Some other international negotiations hit a snag today. The Persians announced they are going to reject a British proposal that the two nations split the profits of Iran's oil production 50-50. However, both sides say these negotiations will continue in the attempt to settle the nationalization dispute, these negotiations which were brought about through the good offices of W. Averill Harriman as ambassador at large representing President Truman. And that's the footnote to the news.
Here's something for every user of regular gas to remember. There's a difference in regular gasolines just as there is in premium gasolines. One regular gas stands out as the best of the regulars. It's American Gas, made by the makers of Amoco Gas to give faster starts, smoother pickup, long mileage. For American Gas, for all famous Amoco products, stop at the Amoco Oval sign of greater values from Maine to Florida. Tune in to Don Hollenbeck tomorrow. This is the CBS Radio Network.